Good afternoon. Thank you so much to Saber for allowing me to speak to you today about this very handsome gentleman, my great-grandfather. He spent 22 years here in New York City playing baseball, and in those 22 years, as you will see, he played a significant role in helping baseball transfer from a gentleman's recreation for fun to a fully organized scientific sport. He was born in Mount Vernon, New Hampshire in 1814. His father, Daniel Adams, was a doctor, a farmer. He wrote arithmetic textbooks that were in publication until the mid-1860s. And he was also a frequent and early orator in the support of the temperance and abolitionist movements. This is the only reference in all the family papers, and I have a great deal, to anything having to do with sports. This letter was written to Doc when he was 17. The year is 1832. He was at Amherst College. This was written by his younger sister, Nancy, who was complaining that she had not played with the bat and ball that he had left at home for her to use. In fact, she had not even seen it since he left. That is our only reference in all the family papers. He transferred from Amherst to Yale and graduated from Yale in 1835. He then went on to Harvard Medical School, where he got his medical degree in 1838, and then moved here to New York City and set up his medical practice. He was also appointed a vaccine physician for the city of New York and earned $400 a year. And he also did volunteer work as an assistant physician with the New York dispensary treating the poor. And he began to play baseball. He joined the Knickerbocker Baseball Club shortly after September of 1845. They had been formed in that month, and he'd been playing with the New York Baseball Club, and some of the younger fellows transferred over to the Knickerbocker Baseball Club. May of the following year, he was elected vice president of the Knickerbockers. The score sheet that you see there is from the June 19, 1846 game that was played in the Elysian Fields in Hoboken. Originally, the Knickerbockers and most clubs here in Manhattan had three locations where they played: Madison Square Park, Murray Hill, and then a third location, the Red House in Harlem. As a matter of fact, tomorrow, June 30th, in 1853, Doc played a game at the Red House in Harlem. But by 1845, the city was expanding, and those two fields in Lower Manhattan were no longer available to them. The Red House in Harlem was around for a very long time, and that's why the Knickerbockers had to find another field, and they contracted to play at the Elysian Fields in Hoboken, New Jersey, which was an established recreational area. The score sheet shows that Doc made three outs. The club lost 23-1. But what I like about the score sheet is in the New York club, the New York Baseball Club, a man named Davis was fined 6 cents for swearing. What you have to keep in mind was this was a gentleman's game. These were men who had day jobs. This was for fun. This was for exercise. And I think on some level they didn't really take it very seriously because it was for fun. But what made the Knickerbockers unique is they left the best records. They wrote everything down. When they were founded, they had 21 rules, 7 of which had to do with how you were to behave. The rest were playing rules. At the time, it was 42 paces between the bases. There was no specification for the distance from pitcher's base to home. There were no gloves, no catcher's mats. The pitch was underhand, and you could not overrun first base. Outs were counted if it was caught on the fly or after a first bounce. I point that out because some of those rules are going to change over time. This is an interview that was done with Doc originally in a Chicago newspaper in 1895. It is the only first-person account known to exist about Doc and what he felt in his own voice about the game. It's very clear in this article that the earliest years of the Knickerbockers, from 1845 to 1851, were very tough years. The New York Baseball Club sort of disappeared after that game in the Elysian Fields in 1846, and there really weren't any other clubs for the Knickerbockers to play against. They had to play amongst themselves, and enthusiasm was very low. Doc says in the article that he would often get to the Elysian Fields on a practice day, and only two or three members would be present. By 1847, Doc was president of the club, a position he would hold six times over his remaining years with the club. So it fell to Doc to encourage people to show up to their matches, all within themselves. They still had nobody else to play against. So he made it as part of his job as president of the club to give people at their club dinners probably what you would now call a pep talk, although he would not have known that term. I think he was probably more persuasive than that, because by 1848, enough members were showing up to play that they had enough people to field for a match. But you can see by the quote, he did it for the love of the game. The other issue that made the game difficult to play, there was nobody manufacturing bats or balls. So Doc had to take it upon himself to take care of that. Doc made all the balls for the club himself. He found a Scottish saddler in Lower Manhattan Island who showed him how to cut up the rubber from his friend's worn-out rubber galoshes. And he would cut the rubber into strips. And the saddler showed him how to make the base of the ball. He would then wind it with yarn and then cover it with leather. So he made all the balls for the club, and he sold them to the club as well. Some of, right here in the New York Public Library, there are some receipts showing that Doc had made the balls for the club and what he charged for them. He also went around to all the various furniture turners here in New York City to have the bats made. He would stand over the turner to make sure that he was getting the right length, diameter, and taper that he wanted for the bats. And so it showed his love of the game that he was willing to go to all this effort to make sure that the members had the proper implements to play the game. As I said, in 1847, he was elected president of the club. By 1848, enough members were showing up that they were starting to have on-field disagreements of play. So the club formed a committee, which Doc headed up, to work on the rules of play, which they did. Nothing earth-shattering came out of those rules. 1849, Doc created the position of shortstop. The balls that he made were so light that they could be batted quite a distance. You just couldn't throw them very far. So this other outfield position, he took it upon himself to move it closer in order to be a relay position from outfield back into the infield. And as the equipment improved, then it came into where you would see a shortstop stand today. In his years with the club, he played every position but pitcher. And I have a note from my grandfather, Doc's youngest son, that says that shortstop was his favorite. In 1849, the New York Knickerbockers got their first uniform. They still didn't have anybody to play against, but they were going to be properly attired. It consisted of blue pantaloons and a white shirt and a chip hat. Would you want to play baseball in a straw hat? I think that'd be kind of tough. By the way, baseball was two words back then. That's why it's on the screen is two words. And that went up pretty much to the 1880-1890s. You'd see both, two words and one. By 1851, there were two other clubs on the scene. They'd been around before, but it sort of fallen away and then came back in 1851. The New York Baseball Club became the Washingtons, and then they changed their name to the Gothams, and then the Eagle Baseball Club. So finally, the Knickerbockers had somebody to play against. And by 1854, again, there were on-field disagreements. The Eagles proposed a meeting of the three clubs to sit down and talk about the rules. Again, nothing too terribly earth-shattering came out of it. It was the first time that the specifications for where the pitcher would be in relationship to home was established as 15 bases. It was still 42 bases behind, between bases, which if you talk to some really smart people, most of whom are in this room, works out to be approximately 75 feet between bases. And those are two buttons that the family has from Doc's uniform. They seem to have been ceremonial. They're too big and too heavy to have played in. But probably the first real provenanced piece of baseball uniform. By 1857, there were approximately 15 clubs now playing here in New York City. And at the December meeting of the Knickerbockers, it was proposed that they get all these clubs together again to discuss the rules. Doc was appointed, along with two other members, William Grinnell and Henry and William Wadsworth, to be on that committee, of course. Doc was still president of the club. And this was when baseball changed from a gentleman's game, and this is when it became a real sport. Some of you might have read last year, that April of last year, certain documents called the Laws of Baseball sold for $3.26 million at auction. Third highest paid for any sports memorabilia, second highest paid for any baseball memorabilia. That's what you're looking at here, part of that set of documents. What you're seeing there is Doc's handwritten Laws of Baseball that he wrote in 1857 in order to have it presented to this convention of the 15 clubs. He was also appointed head of the convention. He presided over it. Lots of new things came out of this. It finally established once and for all 9 innings of play instead of what they had been using, 21 runs. That was how a game ended back then. And now it was finally 9 innings. Doc proposed 9 men to a side. 9 was pretty much traditional at the time, although in the very early years, depending on how many showed up, it could have been 6, it could have been 11, but by this time 9 was traditional, but now it was written down as a law. Additionally, Doc set the base paths at 90 feet, which obviously is still in use today. So instead of 42 bases, it is now 90 feet. And that was, as he said in the interview, he came up with that after careful study. This was also the first time that the pitcher's position was defined. This shows where the pitcher is to stand in terms of his foot and in terms of where he is pitching the ball. Also, for the very first time, and this seems to have been a problem, otherwise there wouldn't have been a law, this also constrained revolving, which would not allow a player to switch from club one to club A, depending on his mood or the time of day. It also set the uniform standards for the bats and the balls. The specifications for the balls were in the 1854 rules, but this was the first time that for the bats it showed up as well in 1857. Doc wrote these laws, and then they were handed on to William Grinnell, who copied them very beautifully, because you could see Doc's handwriting wasn't anything special. And then it was discussed at the convention quite vociferously whether it should be 7 innings or 9 innings. There was quite a faction that wanted 7 innings. And at the very last minute, William Wadsworth, the third member of the Knickerbockers committee, said 9, and it stayed at 9. But that's what Doc had originally written, 9 innings of play. It also shows the size of the ball, its weight. That would change over the years, of course. And then all the specifications for the bat. In the following year, 1858, Doc was elected chairman of the Rules Committee, and he would hold that position until he retired. Doc was an early advocate, along with a lot of other men, not just Doc, for the fly game. He advocated it at this convention, and it did not pass. So the fly game and the bound game, or the one-bounce game, they coexisted till about 1866. Doc and others thought that the fly game made the game more manly. But it didn't pass in exclusivity because there were a lot of new clubs in New York and they still didn't have any gloves. And so a lot of the new players, it would have been very hard for them to catch a ball on the fly. And there were a lot of injuries because of it. So that was the main reason that the bound game coexisted with the fly game for so long. One last thing that was in the laws that I did not say was no wagering by anybody involved with the game. That is a very old rule, and I think it is a very good rule. but that was the first time it was specified. In 1858 was the first All-Star game, the New York clubs, the best of the New York clubs versus the best of the Brooklyn clubs. There were three games that were held at the Fashion Racecourse out on Long Island, which is about a mile and a half from where Citi Field is today. So those of you going to the Mets game tomorrow, you can think about this. Doc was the umpire for the third game, the rubber game, of this All-Star game. It was also the first time an admission was charged. Doc was the first umpire to call men out on non-swinging strikes. He used it three times in that last game of the match. It wasn't used a great deal after that. I don't know why. We'll have to ask Doc in the museum. I'd like to know. That's the game ball for that third game of the Fashion Racecourse games that is on display at the Hall of Fame. That was exciting to see that. This picture is from 1859 from South Brooklyn. It's probably the first and only photograph of the Knickerbockers on a field in their uniform. Doc is, as you can see, is there with his no more straw hat. That did change. They got rid of those idiotic straw hats and they had a real mohair cap later on. He played third base and made three outs. I love the umpire with his top hat. Doc got married in 1861. For the first time, he was 47. His wife was 33. He decided in 1862 to retire and resign from the Knickerbockers, which he did. I know he did it with regret, but his wife was more important than the game was, as much as he loved the game. After really studying some family correspondence, I figured out that by March of 1862, she was pregnant with their first child, and that's why he retired. He was going to be a husband and a father. That became his priority. Sadly, she would lose that baby about 6 months later, and it almost killed her as well. But he did not look back. I am also related to the gentleman second from the left in the back row through Doc's wife, which I only learned within the last 2-3 years. This is a letter from James White Davis, who was secretary of the Knickerbockers. He wrote it to Doc about a month after he retired from the game. What I love about it is the postscript. We regret that you're leaving the club, but just in case you change your mind, playing commences on the 21st. But this was 1862, and I have not yet found any record. It seems that the Knickerbockers didn't play any games in that year, and that certainly would have been the influence of the Civil War. They immediately made him an honorary member for life and named him the Nestor of ball players. And for those of you whose ancient Greek history might be a little rusty, Nestor was a king of ancient Greece who advised the Greeks at the Battle of Troy. So the word has become to mean a trusted and wise advisor. 1861, he got married. In 1865, he retired from medicine and moved to Ridgefield, Connecticut. He became the first president of the Ridgefield Savings Bank, which is now the Fairfield County Bank, where his portrait still hangs in the lobby of the main office. He would hold that position for about 10 of the next 15 years. He was also elected to one term in the Connecticut legislature. He was a founding member and first treasurer of the library in Ridgefield, Connecticut. He did not practice medicine ever again. This was a reunion game that was held by the Knickerbockers in 1875 in the Elysian Fields in Hoboken, and Doc was invited, and he did attend. He was the catcher. These were not young men. Doc was almost 60. So they only made it to 5 innings, and off they went to the nearest restaurant for refreshments and tall tales. What's interesting about this is the umpire, a man by the name of Henry Chadwick. He is the only journalist to have a plaque in the Hall of Fame. He was an early supporter and promoter of baseball from about 1856 on, and of course Doc and he knew each other. This letter was written to Doc from Henry Chadwick in 1898, I forgot the year. It's got the famous quote in it about father of baseball and Topsy. You will read that in other books in many other places. It was written by Henry Chadwick to Doc. This is the other letter that we have from Henry Chadwick to Doc. Doc was complimenting him again on his latest edition of his baseball guide that Chadwick published into the early 1900s, and saying what a wonderful job he's done to promote baseball and baseball, and thank you so much. And this was Chadwick's response. Doc and the family moved to New Haven, Connecticut in 1885. His two sons were at Yale, and it was a financial sacrifice to have his two boys there. So they moved to New Haven so the boys could live at home and save some money. But well into his late 70s, Doc would still join his sons in backyard play and even made the balls for them, too. I have all sorts of reports of that from my grandfather. He died on January 3rd, 1899. The quote on the bottom of the screen really tells you what you need to know most about Doc outside of baseball. In 1881, he was asked to write a little autobiography for a Yale alumni publication. That quote tells you what you need to know. My marriage was the crowning achievement of my life, because this little autobiography has no mention of baseball whatsoever, as much as he loved the game. These are just some of the people I need to thank, and half of them are here in the room, so I can also thank you in person. And now, I'll be happy to take whatever questions anybody might have. Careful, if you don't ask a question, there might be a pop quiz. Okay, yes?
How did you say you're related to Doc Adams?
He is my great-grandfather. My grandfather was born in 1874. Doc was 60. My grandfather was about 37 years old when my father was born. And my father was 40 when I was born. So that's why there are only just a couple of generations between us. Those Adams men are in no hurry whatsoever. Sir?
Yes, did Doc have a relationship with Jim Creighton of the Excelsiors?
I doubt it. They might have known each other, but he did have a relationship with Harry Wright. Harry Wright joined the Knickerbockers in 1858, and he did play in the first of that All-Star game that I mentioned. And it's interesting to see how baseball grew, because it was about 9 years later that Harry Wright is in Cincinnati, about to form the Cincinnati Red Stockings. So it really is a tribute to Doc and his efforts to keep the game going in those very early days of the Knickerbockers, when it was so difficult just to get people to show up. Anyone else? Yes?
The ball was difficult to throw, hence the shortstop position.
Yes. I don't know. I really don't. And that's on my list of questions to ask him someday. I've got a very long list, as you can imagine. I think they probably liked it that way. It was challenging. It was manly. So beyond that, I couldn't tell you. There may be some in this room who already know the answer to that, and I will defer to them. Yes?
You said that he stopped playing at the time he got married.
At that time, really not many, because of the Civil War. Up until the Civil War, they might only get in 7 or 8 games in a season, because so many people left the city in the summer because it was so hot, and cholera epidemics, which Doc attended to as a physician. He treated people for cholera. So there weren't that many games played in any year. And because these were all men who had jobs, they couldn't just drop everything. as much as they might have wanted to. So there really weren't that many games played at all. And in 1862, according to the records, the Knickerbockers did not play one game. Yes?
Yes, he's being considered for the Hall of Fame. Have you heard anything lately?
Or... not as much as I'd like to. He was on the ballot in 2015. It was his first time on the ballot. There were 9 other people on the ballot. He needed 12 votes. He got 10. But he got the most of anybody on the ballot. The next ballot will be 2020. So anybody who would like to help me out to see that he is on the ballot and subsequently gets inducted, I won't turn down that assistance because I want to get this done. Yes?
Why does history kind of miss or ignore the rules of 1857 that's not mentioned in many of the general histories?
I don't think they really knew that much. It's been alluded to and quoted over the years, but in terms of the verbatim that we get with Doc's Laws of Baseball, I mean, I've been told by many people that if those laws of baseball that were sold last year had gone to auction in 2015, he would have gotten in, because that's the primary evidence. And, well, timing is everything, and the timing wasn't with us. I just don't think it was all written down. Sure. Oh, my time's up. Okay.
One more question.
Okay.
Was Doc Adams, the Adams family, related to the Adamses that were well known in Brooklyn?
Brooklyn, New York. Probably. The first Adams that came over here had 8 children. Most of them were boys. We're descended from one line. The presidential line is descended from another. I would never pass the DNA test. But I am sure most Adamses in this country are related. I'm glad I don't have to send them all Christmas presents, because there must be millions of them. Thank you very much.